Park Place Summer School, 1977. Questions and answers after morning lecture on Saturday, the 21st of May.
I've told you the story time and again, how at school my little red-headed boy in the lab, Jackson was his name, he, after a few minutes, would always be sort of fighting a little bit with the fellow next to him for some reason or other. So I used to call him to attention and tell him to stop that nonsense. One fine day, called him up after the chemistry period was over and said, Jackson, why do you always sort of get into a tussle with the fellow next to you, whoever he may be? He looked at me and said, sir, I like fighting. You know, he was bursting with energy always, spilling the beans constantly. Even when he offered the explanation, which was no explanation, you see, really, he couldn't contain himself. I suppose it's a slight defect functioning of the organism. One couldn't help it.
And angry people very often seem to create energy the opposite way around. Their very anger seems to give them energy.
You see, the feeling of anger injects more adrenaline into the blood, you see. And when there is this excess of adrenaline, you get the phenomenon associated with anger. You see? Mind you, all these things are not altogether under our control. And frequently throughout life, one can't bring these things under one control because the organism to start with is a bit lopsided. It's the fundamental blueprint with which you start. Start with a fundamental defect, what's going to get it right? But you see, if one is intelligent and one is really mindful and observes that functioning, doesn't fight against it, but remains, this is where the sort of self-intelligent self-restraint comes in, remains poised and just looking, then the least possible harm accrues, and one learns a lot about oneself and about other human beings. Therefore, when we see other human beings similarly upset and suffering, we have understanding for them. We don't get upset, annoyed, angry with them, as I do sometimes with people.
For us, taking your analogy of the petrol tank, the attractiveness of energy, it seems most of one's time hardly any petrol gets into the tank, but it's leaking out the whole time in our sleep. At times like here, the tank fills up with this energy. There always seems to be, as the question said, when it gets full, there's almost invariably an explosion of getting rid of it. And this seems to me, the energy comes in because I is hardly there at all. When the energy builds up, the ego gets hold of it, and then the something like that, as far as one, the I gets hold of it. of the energy and then the complete loss of force.
Did you say earlier when you started asking the question that in sleep one loses energy?
Psychological sleep. Unawares.
Yes. And in the unmindful sleep.
In the unmindful, yeah.
I see. So, would you please say again what precisely is the question?
I think
the eye. You said the eye gets hold of this energy.
Yes. Well, I think my question is basically following on the other question of where we get energy, where we get force, such as here and now.
I see.
And then the force of energy builds up to a very much larger extent than we've normally got in life, and then when it gets to that level, dissipation.
Here you must remember that there is the influence of the mass involved. If we had a certain physical job to do, manual.
Yes.
One person doing it, you see, using his strength, let us say would take 2 hours, you see. Now, two people doing it, provided they don't waste their time with cups of tea and smokes and so on, you see, and with futile conversation and argument and all those things. But if two people really worked together as a team, they'll do it under the hour. It won't be 2 hours divided by one, divided by two, you see. Similarly, the other way around, there is an integration of power, of the combined power, which is not merely additive. It doesn't mean if one person turns up X units of energy, therefore 10 people will turn up 10X units of energy. It will be usually, provided it is all done intelligently. It will be much more than 10x. This action.
Perhaps as I've lost
keeping what?
My. He's frightened, you'll kick him. You see? Now, we think, we imagine that we are thinking our own thoughts, we are experiencing our own feelings, our own reactions. We think in this wholly isolated personal way. But when, even when you are alone, are you the sole responsible agent for the thought, the feeling?
No.
No, quite. You see, there is the psychical atmosphere around you all the time. There are forces at play, and they are vast and immense, which are working upon you. Take the simplest of all examples. When we are in a place like this, peace and quiet, you see, what effect has the turmoil of the city upon us? And yet it is going on. And it is radiating all that influence. But by the time that radiation reaches us, it is considerably diminished. Because here it is very intense, and as that intensity moves out, it becomes less and less intense because it's moving right out through space, isn't it? So we are practically oblivious of it. When we go back from here to the city, we shall be under the full impact of it, won't we? And so what happens in terms of our own reactions, our own thoughts and feelings, is quite different from our thoughts and feelings here. But here too, our thoughts and feelings are susceptible to the impact of the whole psychical atmosphere, which we can't see, we don't know. Now this is where the fully developed religia and or yogi, you see, is well aware, is sensitive to it. So this explosiveness which takes place is not due to just ourselves, but to the influence of those around us also.
Yes, I suppose very much in a group like we are now here, with your analogy of the two people, the force generated by a group together, even with the little work that we are doing, generates
an immense amount.
Yes.
You see, energy in its reality, its primordial reality, is self-generating and self-subsisting. Otherwise the universe couldn't be, it would just disappear. This ultimate reality is necessarily self-subsisting and self-generating. Now this is well exemplified in the nature of any living cell. What are the three most outstanding characteristics of the living cell? It has self-motivation, self-reproduction, and self-healing, whilst it is a living organism. It's a mystery how it is. It works from within like this. This energy which functions through what we perceive as living cells in these three forms, this transcendent energy shows itself to us, or we see it in this manner. Self-motivation, self-reproduction, self-healing. But therefore, that energy in itself must be perpetually self-generating, perpetually self-replenishing, and so forth. Otherwise, with the death of living cells, would be a vacuum to make the case.
You did say 2 days ago, Thoreau, that a person who can become purified, when they die, they have purified the cosmic world.
Yes.
So doesn't this lead to the responsibility of not throwing your energy about?
Exactly.
This is really what my question is.
Absolutely. Yes. Don't squander it, you see. It's very difficult to suggest or explain how not to squander it, because it's not like coins or notes of money, you see, which you can either spend away like that, because they are finite things which you can handover. You can't do that sort of thing with your own life energy. It's a case of being, remaining mindful. This word mindfulness is the very linchpin of the whole developmental process by which the individual human being comes to fruition. The thousands of millions in the world do not come to fruition in the true sense. They just live, they die. You see, all their problems and the problem engendered by the fact of their existence itself is never resolved, because the resolution of a problem means the fruition, the harmony in the true sense. Death shatters the problem in that case. This is what happens. That is why in the world, confining ourselves to the human kingdom, there is a certain degree of reality to this sense of, to this waste paper basket material. The bulk of human beings are like that. You see, the potentiality of fruition is in each and every single cell itself. The potentiality is there. But whether that potentiality will come to proper flower in the particular human being is another matter. And that, whether it comes to full flower or not, is our personal responsibility, essentially our personal responsibility. Also, the responsibility, right from infancy onwards, of parents, teachers, friends, our social heritage, etc. You see? And in most cases, there is no real fruition. There is a certain slight advance constantly, very slow, but there is an advance. Because if there weren't some sort of advance, the very appearance and structure of the human body wouldn't undergo the changes that it has undergone during the last 2-3 million or whatever it is, X million years that man has been on the globe. And the change in his structure has been accompanied by fruitive changes in his capacities, etc. I mean, you and I can do things today which 100,000 years ago our dear old Acherlian great-great-great-great to the power X grandfather never could do. So there is a certain growth, but mostly death shatters the problem. And in the case of the truly intelligent one, the one who does blossom out into true humanity, humanness in its full sense, there, when death comes as the final consummation of the whole unfolding process and resolves any problem that there may still be present. This power of resolution, and death and life are the same energy.
Is this what you mean when you talk about death the great destroyer and death the great consummator? In other words, the great number of humanity that just go and that's it. And the consummation is the level of development you are at, you can add to the psychical world or atmosphere as a result of more of a cleansed personality. Is that really it?
Something like that, yes. You know, this is where the Katha Upanishad is one of the really extraordinary presentations. The Hindu mind has its own very special imaginative quality. Take, for instance, in the first instance, the Bhagavad Gita. Look at its setting. Here is a mighty war taking place, comparable for that age and that climate and that population, much smaller than our population, with our world convulsing wars which we have known twice in our lifetime. Here is this war taking place on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and the Lord of the universe, embodied as Krishna, is asked a question by Arjuna, who is seated in the chariot. Krishna is the driver. He's the one who leads. It's important, you see. He's asked a question because Arjuna suddenly gets struck with the fact that these people are kinsmen, friends, comrades, etc., etc. We are engaged in a terrible, destructive, murderous act, you see. My limbs quake. Gandiva, the great bow, the irresistible bow with which he shoots the deadly arrows, falls from his lips out of his hand and all the rest of it. And Krishna then delivers the famous discourse of 18 cantos. Now just imagine this mighty war taking place and two embattled forces all sitting beautifully cross-legged and happy, listening to the discourse delivered by the Lord of the universe to his disciples. What an imagination! And when he finishes, they all say, thank you, thank you. You see? And then, like Jackson, they have a set too. Now take the Katha Upanishad. Nachiketasa's father, the Brahman, is making a big sacrifice and giving away all his possessions. He's going to go completely into the life of the forest with no possessions whatsoever. Now the name Nachiketas, Nachiketas, those are the two parts of that name. The name means the unknowing one. Think of the word Parsifal, the name of Parsifal, the pure fool, pure fool, the unknowing one. The son says to his father, Father, to whom will you give me? And father doesn't take any notice of the little fellow, you see. And he asks the question three times. Father gets annoyed, you see, loses his inner poise, and he says, to death I give you, to Yama. Yama is the lord of death. And Yama is the name also of the first mortal, in the Rig Veda, who found his way to heaven, to the first mortal to find complete fulfillment, and he was granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. Three heavens, like St. Paul, taken up into the third heaven, etc. It's very interesting, all these things. Right? So the son dutifully goes to the mansion of the Lord of Death, but he is absent, and so he waits there until the Lord of Death returns, and he waits 3 days. Again, this third day business comes in. He waits 3 days. And the Lord of Death finds him waiting there, and he's extremely apologetic. He says, I'm so sorry to keep a Brahman waiting like this. What can I do for you? Have a little preliminary exchange of courtesies. No wine or sherry. Preliminary exchange of courtesies. And the Lord of Death says, ask any three boons. The first two boons involve the knowledge on the practical side of the whole rule of yoga. Interesting, the whole rule of yoga. Then Nachiketas, the unknowing one, asks the great question. Some say after death he is not. Some say after death he is. What is the truth of this? And Yama says, please don't ask me that question. You see, that is a question which even the great sages have wanted to know and could not, and the mystery couldn't be solved. And he says, instead of that, he takes off a great necklace and gives it to him and says, ask anything else, you can have all the pleasures of the earth and so forth. And Yama says, and Nachiketa says, what is the use of all these pleasures of the senses and this wealth and kingdoms and so forth with you, the ender of all, in sight? And then Yama makes that wonderful statement. Nachiketas is a vessel fit for the highest. You know, it's wonderfully touching and uplifting. And he doesn't answer the question as you and I would expect to answer, what happens after death? Because the question is self-negating. The entity has completely ceased to be an entity. And when the entity ceases to be an entity, there is no such thing as anything happening to it. It has become universalized. So he delivers to him the great teaching of the Atma and the meaning of the word Atma, you see. It's one of the most wonderful discourses. And then at the end, you find this. Wait a minute. Oh, somebody got Thor. May I please borrow? Thank you very much. Then Nachiketas, this is the end of the Katha Upanishad, having received the knowledge declared by death, the Lord of Death, and the whole teaching of yoga, realized Brahman, the Absolute, and became free from passion, immortal. And so may any other who knows this in regard to the Atma. There was no entity, Nachiketas, talking with an entity death. This living being himself was really a yogi who had developed far enough to be able to enter the supreme state which man can realize, what the Buddha called the cessation, what in the Rig Veda was called the lordship or entry into the third heaven, what in the Upanishads is called the Turiya state, you see, and so forth, which all the mystics call the Unio Mystica, the ultimate union with the Divine. See, entered into that state. And it is in that state that life, death do not mean different things at all. All physical words and symbols have their limitations. If we say, use the use a coin, we talk of the other side of the coin. Death is the other side of the coin, of one side of the coin, and life, what we call life, is the other side of the same. See, he gives that teaching. And Nachiketas realizes the ultimate truth. Now, this, in a context like this, the Lord of Death stands for that extraordinary state where you yourself can totally denude yourself. Your whole psyche is utterly denuded, you see, and so forth. The giving up, the voluntary and complete giving up, the letting go, no grasping. See why the Buddha says, Ananda, and this is deathlessness, the cessation of all grasping, deathlessness. You see the identification of death with life there, in using the term deathlessness. And so, I have written here in talking about that, just a few words about that in a later chapter, is that the Lord of Death says to Nachiketas, give up your selfness and my immortal twin will suffuse you with eternal life. The immortal twin. Life and death as the immortal twins. You look at it that way and then you'll understand that therefore when the individual is filled with the awareness which is utter selflessness, you see, no separation between you and me, this and that, etc. A full awakening to the unitary wholeness as such, then death is the consummating aspect of life. And if one really sees that, not take it merely as a thought or a pleasant idea or something like that, or poetic expression, one really sees that. The fear of death and a thousand and one other fears associated with it vanish. Just vanish. Mindfulness becomes much, much easier. See, the beginnings of greed are involved in the fear of death. This sort of life and death struggle that the infant in the act of being born goes through. When it gets caught there, in those few seconds in which the midwife pulls the little brat out, you see. But who knows what happens to that new consciousness which is emerging as going to be self-consciousness? What's happening there? The impress on that living organism of this struggle to be separate from the original home, out of the original home, the womb. See, now, the fear of death, perhaps, I only suggest it's just a conjecture on my part. Please don't take it as gospel. It's just a suggestion. The fear of death may originate there. You see? Now, how does the ignorant one counteract the fear of death? Because in the state of ignorance, we are all the time counteracting this, counteracting that, which is the mistaken way. Instead of seeing that everything has to be transformed, not counteracted, which is a perpetuation of conflict. You see? Why is there greed? This sort of instinct that, oh, if I have this, I will, and I can subsist on it. I can eat this, I can drink this, I can continue to live. And then that grows and grows in relation to possessions, to things. So we accumulate things and all the rest of it. For self-preservation, meaning the preservation of the separate entity. So greed starts perhaps like that. And the moment greed is frustrated, there's resentment. You've heard every little infant yell, haven't you?
It seems that, in a way, I don't know if I've got to treat it wrong or not, it would seem that the higher powers, or whatever one likes to call them, in a way, have not the slightest interest in the individual physically, on his death, crossing a road, a car coming, a volcano, earthquake. Not the slightest interest in this, but a great deal of interest in the psychic.
Your question has its origin in this. You say higher powers, or whatever they may be, or these archetypal energies on the universal scale and so forth. You see, whatever is on the universal scale cannot possibly have a personal interest. So it is not that they don't care, in our sense of the word care. Our sense of the word care doesn't apply to universal forces.
We're invisible.
Pardon?
We are almost invisible to them. We are invisible. In a way.
They just function on the universal scale as such, and they're oblivious. Again, the words are difficult because these are all human terms which are applicable to the limited human context. You know, this is one of the very, very great difficulties in trying to produce explanations of the relationship of the living individual being to that which is universal. This is where all philosophies and all theologies make many errors. We all do, every one of us who, when we talk about these things, what we say is liable to considerable error all the time. Because we can only talk in terms of words, which are all limited things. And they can't, they are not the fit vehicle to express the unlimited. Can't do it.
Words slip, slide, lose their precision. Get it.
Like that. Well, look, dear people, look what you are missing. So you can have your meditative walk, or I'll use the words of the Buddha, do what you think fit. Give the full meaning to the word fit, and also to think.